This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
So guys, we realized just before we sat down to record this that we have two actors who have two projects out this season. What a lovely coincidence, but entirely appropriate because you have interviews with two actors who are incredibly talented and are getting to show us even more of that range. Let's start with you, David, and your conversation with Colman Domingo. I do feel like we have been talking about him so much this season, even before the strike ended and he was able to talk to us, because both Rustin and The Color Purple have been majorly on our radars this entire time. So what was it like finally getting to tell him how great he is?
I think he sensed that, you know, this was going to be a moment for him. And there was understandably some frustration of, you know, waiting to get to talk about it. But Colman is somebody who's been in this business for a long time and who has been, and he's pretty open about this in the interview, waiting for an opportunity like this for a long time and makes really good on it. And both Rustin and The Color Purple projects he did back to back, which is kind of insane to me, given the very unique demands of both of them. But he certainly pulled it off.
Yeah, we've been talking about The Color Purple on the show more recently because it's been screening more widely. And it feels like, you know, maybe if he's not the one name everyone comes out of The Color Purple talking about, I think the female co-stars are taking more of the attention. It really just bolsters the Rustin campaign and also the sense that he is just someone you absolutely cannot take your eyes off of in any film.
Yeah, and it's really, for me, between the two of them, the range. I mean, these are completely different characters. They require completely different styles of acting. And he is completely feels like the perfect fit for both somehow. And I think that's a real credit. And he talks about this to what he's been through in this industry, which is like having to be a utility player on so many different kinds of projects where, you know, as he sees it now, he can play any role. He can step into any project and be a guy who can get the job done and make something special out of it.
Yeah, well, I really want to hear his perspective on all of that. So let's hear your conversation with the star of both Rustin and The Color Purple, Colman Domingo.
All right, we have Colman Domingo here, MVP kind of the fall movie season. He is star of Rustin, streaming on Netflix, and he's also a key player in The Color Purple. Hi, Colman.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm so excited I can talk to you. The strike is over. And you had a couple movies that were struck projects, so it's good to have you here. To start, let's start a little meta, because obviously these movies are coming out, especially Rustin, which you are number one on. You are the lead of this movie. The rollout had to start without you a little bit, but I know you're getting out there. So how have you experienced suddenly sharing this movie with people?
You know, it's like always... basically shut out of the cannon last Wednesday night.
That sounds right.
Literally, it sounds about right, because I was, that evening that the strike ended, I was on a plane to Washington, D.C., where we had press, and also we had a presentation of our film for HBCU college students that was introduced by President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. So... it
no small thing.
No small thing, but something about this leg of the journey. You know, it premiered at Telluride and TIFF. And, you know, of course, the machine of it was working without me. Mm-hmm. And then the idea for me to jump on board when it's in Washington, D.C., where that was where we finished filming Rustin. And there's so much about the film, about creating, you know, the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. It felt so purposeful and so right that this is exactly the way we should roll this film out with my participation. So it felt incredible, honestly. It felt, I don't know, it reminded me of like being so mindful and intentional about this film and mm-hmm. The impact that we hope that it could have, you know, by telling a story about Bayard Rustin and making him the central character in his own story and looking at his legacy and his intent and how he organized the March on Washington.
Yeah. No, I think that's so beautifully put. And this really is a movie where it feels bigger than the performance. It feels bigger than what you bring to it as an actor, because as you say, this is a film where I know you've said one of your missions here is to make sure people never forget or don't know who this man is again. Can you talk about the responsibility of stepping into the role, both as an actor and as someone who is now getting to talk about him and share, you know, how extraordinary his contributions were?
It's tremendous. I have a photo of Bayard Rustin on my wall because he really is a North Star in many ways of being purposeful and intentional in the world and being your whole, full self without apology. Mm-hmm. So I knew that that was a tremendous undertaking, especially a film like this where I'm pretty much in every frame of this film. And it's seismic what I have to do. It is it requires you to be a bit of a virtuoso in a way, because he was a virtuoso. This was a man that doesn't come along every day. He played the lute and sang Elizabethan love songs, was a star athlete, and he was a young communist. He was an advisor mm-hmm. to Dr. King, you know, and he was openly gay at a time when it would cost him his entire livelihood. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, be a violation to his body in many ways. So there was a great opportunity to infuse this character that is unsung in history with as much humanity, as much complexity, as much love and grace, enthusiasm and passion as I could. Because also I felt a responsibility not only to, it's the first time his story is really being pulled out of the history books and told, but because there are people who are living who, you're beholden to. You know, it's like, you know, people who knew him, who worked side by side with him and knew of his impact and influence, and also questioned why he was pretty much erased from the history books, you know? So there's a great responsibility. And I know for me, I feel I'm filled with gratitude that the people who knew and loved him, they see the work and the effort and all the love that I poured into this portrayal. Because it is bigger than me. It's what I can do as an artist. Those rare times you get as an artist to really pour everything you have into it and all your skills and all the things you've been doing in the theater and television, you know, as a writer, as a director, as a producer, to create this film. It called on everything that I had. I couldn't have done this film, I think, 20 years ago. It wouldn't make sense. The wildest thing is I just realized just the other day that Bayard was 51 years old when he organized the March on Washington, and I was 51 years old when I filmed it.
Wow.
I needed that history. I needed that experience in my life to actually bring to Rustin, so I understood where he was coming from in his life.
Yeah, you're talking about the career, too, of a working actor, a working artist, who I think this is your first feature where you're number one on the call sheet. Am I right about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is for me to actually recognize that, because I've just been too busy just doing work. You know what I mean? Like, you keep your nose to the ground, you're doing the work and showing up. And then at some point, you realize, I didn't even realize that I hadn't been number one on the call sheet. I've just been trying to get work. I've been number 3, I've been number 4, I've been number 9, I've been number 68. But I hope that people can see that this is the work of a journeyman, an artist that has been working for a very long time. And it hasn't been the easiest road, but it has been a fulfilling road. And I think by not being number one on the call sheet taught me how to create for myself, how to create opportunities and produce and direct and write and all these other things. So that's been wonderful. And so the idea of having this moment in my career is truly remarkable. Because, you know, I have many comrades it doesn't happen for. And they're just as talented and they work just as hard. But I know that I've worked incredibly hard and I've been worked hard to create and to be kind and to give myself access. And so it's nice when suddenly you're having a moment like this. I can't deny it. It's an extraordinary moment I'm having in my career. Extraordinary.
I would add very deserved. You were talking about what you put into this performance and the many layers that go into Bayard Rustin. And when I saw this film in Telluride, and what stayed with me for days was your exuberance in the part and the joy it felt so alive. And obviously a lot of that comes from the man himself. But from what I'm hearing and from what I saw, it also sounded like that was you a little bit coming into that part.
I think so. I was raised by a mother and a father who really helped me shape my idea of this world, believing that the world is more good than not. I am very hopeful. I wake up. I know I'm a joyful person. I wake up with a smile. I wake up excited about the possibility of what this day is going to be like and what I can do and be a part of in it. I'm an optimistic person. So also, I knew that that was a part of Bayard. It was very true. Anyone who knew him said that he walks into a room and yet charisma for days, and he was excited about what tomorrow brings. So I knew that we were brothers in that way. I know I can bring that part of myself, that fullness in myself, and my experience, without apology, you know? This film, in my mind, it is not the stuffy biopic, the sort of like, you know, putting the medicine down your throat, making you swallow. It really is, I think it's a joyous expression of organizing and being hope-filled and believing in the possibility of this country and your place in it. I don't know, I think it's joyful. And I think that's what I feel like I got from him when I would, in all my research about Rustin, he's a very hopeful human being. And I wanted to call on that part of myself every day, not only in the way I portrayed him, but also in the way I led the set every single day. Mm-hmm. Whether they heard the music coming from my trailer or the way I would show up on set and say hello and hug everyone, I wanted to share that feeling.
Yeah. Can you take us inside the technical part of playing him and how you figured out the physicality and this speaking pattern? He's a very particular guy in addition to everything you're talking about.
Yes, it is. He's first of all, it required, I think, the moment I knew the film was green lit and I was a part of it, I think I had about 5 months of preparation. Mm-hmm. And I'm very rigorous when it comes to preparing because that's all I understand.
Sure.
Whether it's examining his writings or his debates or his interviews, I would look at the way he sat with his leg crossed or the way he would have his finger, you know, his index finger on the side of his face with a portrait. And I would question the choices or all the moments around that to get there. And, you know, and even also physically, I would look at, you know, the way he moved his body through spaces and whether how different it was when he was in a boardroom from when he was sitting at home. And I could see a different body and the way he took up space. And then his voice, he had a mid-Atlantic standard accent.
Yes.
That he created for himself. Yeah. He's from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And he was such an original. And I think he even gave himself an original dialect, which is awesome. And then I had to interpret why would someone make up their own accent. And I thought, well, I think it's a useful tool. Language is a great tool to let people hear you differently, why you stand out from the rest of the pack, why how you want to drive your point home. And then there are times when the accent, and I was very conscious of it from scene to scene, there are times where I'll pull off of the accent just a bit, where I feel he's a bit more vulnerable, or he's just at home, or no one's watching, you know? And then sometimes I would dial it up when he needs to have a flourish or gain on the room that he was in. So we really worked to make sure that I was playing with his body and his voice and the way he moved his spaces in a virtuosic way. You know what I mean? And so you're playing him like a violin.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So you are working with George C. Wolfe here, and he's a director you've, of course, worked with previously. And it felt very much like a George C. Wolfe production. He's a legend of theater. He's populated this film with many titans of theater. But what's your relationship with him like, just in terms of collaboration, and how did that inform what you bring to the movie?
Yeah, it's great. I think our relationship has grown in such an incredible way since we worked on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I think that was sort of our test tube time of how mm-hmm. we operate together. George is a great critical thinker. He's a visionary director, and he's also very much an actor's director. So he's willing to get in the fray with you and really unpack, you know, motivations, intentions, language in an extraordinary way. And so I think that when he knew he wanted me to play Byron Rustin, this had to be a very different partnership. This isn't just direct an artist and craft it. You know, he's got a film to make, yes. But I have ownership of so much of the soul of the character and also how it operates. So I think that there really is a great balance with the two of us. And we had to trust each other in a very new, unique way. I think that we found a sense of even more delicacy, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. in the way and nuance in the way that we created moments together, because he also knew that I had to own this character in a different way. It wasn't just as part of the ensemble. I had to own and really understand his heart and trajectory. Mm-hmm. That does give you a more sense of ownership and advocacy for a character in moments and what makes sense. And we very much were, I think it's a great partnership that we had on Rustin.
Hmm. How did you find being in virtually every scene of this movie? How did you find going between so many really incredible actors, legendary actors? You have this scene with Audra McDonald where she just kind of brings it down. And Glenn Turman, of course, was also in Ma Rainey. But being the one who's suddenly playing off of all of these different energies, I mean, it's got to be quite an experience.
It is. It is. And I think you have to be, I guess, up for the task. I knew that even in the prep, I did my work. But then the next level of the exciting work is to respond, to really listen and respond to these other incredible actors that's populating the film. So I had the lion's share of them. I had the best of the best, which is great on a daily basis. And a lot of young artists who are just, you know, making their debuts. You know, I've never been an actor who has sort of like, I won't ever rehearse something and not be open to what is being brought to me. I love that moment that you can't rehearse, you know? It's like, I've seen actors do it and it drives me insane. I thought, was that fun for you? to just figure out the whole thing. And no matter what they bring to you, whatever gifts they bring to you as an artist, you don't even take it in because you've got an idea about it already. I'm not an actor. I will rehearse and do all my stuff and get my work done. And then I'm open. I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't know that you were going to deliver that line to me this way. Mm-hmm. I will respond like this. So every scene should feel different, I think, because that's true to human nature. You respond differently and you're different in every room. And, you know, so mm-hmm. that's the beautiful thing, that everyone came bringing their A game every single day.
Did it feel strange at all to suddenly be the person who, I guess, is setting the tone, as you're saying? I would imagine you'd observed a lot of other people do it, maybe some better than others, but it's a kind of another role on top of having to do so much on camera.
It is, yet I sort of have been the character that has helped set the tone in many films.
That's true.
that I was not the lead in, which is interesting. I would point to Thelma with David Oyelowo. Mm-hmm. I prayed with David before his speeches. I would make him laugh. I'm almost like the warm-up guy. I was the one on his shoulders, warming up and getting him ready for it, because I knew the work that he had to do. Mm-hmm. You know, David had to do exceptional work for Selma. But I was the one there making sure the rest of the company was doing good. And, you know, I would make sure we were having dance parties on the days off and stuff like that. So I was sort of the party planner around it to make sure that my central character can do what they need to do. Now, for this experience, I need to do both. You know, I needed to be, I was the birthday boy and I was planning the party.
Yep.
I was
your own party planner. Yes.
I was my own. So I was able to be my own, which was such a blessing, because I think finally, after so many years in this industry, I kind of knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. I knew the shortcomings and the blind spots of other number one on the call sheets. And I knew the traps of being number one on the call sheet too. I didn't want to be in a silo. I didn't want to be, you know what I mean? I'm like, no, I'm actually a leader of people. So I have to be involved with people. I couldn't just all of a sudden just, you know, have this sheen around me. That didn't make sense. That didn't make sense with the intention of this film.
So what was the window like between Rustin and Color Purple? I mean, it's
5 minutes. I filmed Rustin, and then I think I had maybe a couple weeks off and went straight to Color Purple.
Wow.
And then I shot another film of mine that premiered at TIFF that I produced, called Sing Sing.
Brilliant film, by the way.
Thank you. I produced, really? I did Sing Sing. And then I went back to do pickups of Rustin the next day. So wow. I did three films back to back.
And completely different characters. I mean, the reason I asked that from Rustin to Color Purple is because I don't want to say in terms of the characterizations you're going from light to dark, but there is a real darkness in terms of what you have to bring to Color Purple. How did you find that transition?
I think it's because, again, it points to the early work that I did in the theater. I was always sort of the utility actor who played five different roles. So I know how to hold five different experiences all at the same time. So it's something I just know how to do. It's one of, and I think I didn't know that that would be a strength of mine, but I can hold containers of completely different human beings. I don't know. And I think that just comes from doing what I've been doing for over 32 years. You know what I mean? And I feel like, okay, yeah. Yes, I'm good at that. I don't know if I'm good at everything, but I'm good at that.
Built for this moment you're having in a lot of ways, right?
I would say yes, I am. I guess I am. I know that I'm built for this moment, and I'm lucky that these moments of amplification in my career are happening now and not 10, 20 years ago. I don't know if I have a grounded sense of who I am and what I do in this industry, that it doesn't become insanely noisy. Mm-hmm. There's a knowingness of your work and your work ethic and who you are and what you believe in that is not swayed in this moment.
Let me close then by asking you about how it feels as an actor, because when you have these three projects that you're looking at back to back, you're clearly, I mean, anyone who's watched you knows you're a great actor. And it's really exciting to see you step into this space. But, you know, with a lead comes maybe a richer role, a role like you're talking about with Rustin, where you have these 5 months. Did you feel pushed or challenged in some way to be able to bring that, particularly to screen roles and to kind of that full bearing?
Yeah, I generally don't do work unless it challenges me and unless it frightens me a little bit, to be honest. Mm-hmm. When I was cast as Rustin, and the same goes for Color Purple, the moment you're cast and there were offers, you think, can I do this? And I actually think, I'm not exactly sure how to do it, but I'm very curious on how to get it done. And I think that maybe that little bit of stress, that little bit of insecurity is what we all need to create, to be honest. I think any legendary human that I've ever worked with, they have a sense of feeling like they don't have it all, that they're not exactly sure. There isn't this robust confidence to where it's like, oh, I got this. If you feel like you got it, I think you shouldn't do it. It doesn't make sense to me. So even when I did Zola, when Genixa Bravo cast me in that, I was very unsure that I could play this role. I was like, I don't know. But I know I had the capacity to do the research and do the work to figure out this character. I had the curiosity to make this person human and to love a character who I think is, you know, vile. You know, but I want to figure out how to love this character and how they need to exist in the world and in this film. And that's what I think. So that's always been something that I do with every bit of work that I do. Putting together a film like Sing Sing, there's no blueprint for that. It feels like it could all fail. But I know that at the center is a pure beating heart and people who want to do something that is about amplifying disenfranchised people. Mm-hmm. And their stories. And I know that that's the thing as we're talking about it at my core. That's what I care about. I care about, you know, the work that I'm creating and for generations and what's meaningful. And if it sparks anything that has to do with that, and I feel like I want to do the work to try to get closer to getting it right, that's exciting. That keeps me wanting to do this work. That which is why I love what I do. But I also love what I do because I think that I feel like I have some access and agency in what I do, in the stories that I tell. Because I've always had that, you know, early in my career, because when I was early in this business of struggling artist, a struggling actor, I had to learn how to create work for myself, work that was meaningful, work that I cared about, instead of playing every stupid criminal on Nash Bridges, which I did do a lot of that. But I want to create things that I cared about. And that gave me power. And that's why I always try to tell my fellow actors, we cannot sit and wait for opportunities. We have to create them. We have to create these worlds. We have to come together and you can create, because that's the biggest gift. No one can tell you not to create. Create from wherever you are that's meaningful and purposeful. And your success is measured by your own success. Not whether or not, you know, you're on the cover of this magazine or whatever, but I'm like, if you're working and you're just working in these very small places, but feel like you're making a difference and being an artist fully, you're successful.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. They're sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So, Rebecca, now let's hear your conversation with Jacob Elordi, who, kind of like Colman Domingo, we've been talking about for a long time, and we knew we wanted to talk to him about his performance in Priscilla, but we're really waiting until the strike would end so we could dive into Saltburn, in which he plays such an incredibly fun, likable, weird, reminds you of the guys you had a crush on in high school kind of character. And I really hope you got into all the many Livestrong bracelet nuances of his role in Saltburn. You forgot handsome, Katie. You forgot one well, of the I mean, most important adjectives.
It's Jacob Elordi. I feel like that goes without saying.
Yeah, yeah. The minute the strike ended, I knew I wanted to reach out to him because he hasn't been able to talk about Saltburn, whereas he has been talking about Priscilla. But what was interesting to me is that, you know, he shot these two projects 3 weeks apart, and now he's having sort of this really incredible year again, kind of like Coleman. I mean, showing this range that really proves that he can be, you know, that leading man part. So, yeah, he had a lot to say about getting into character and, you know, switching between, you know, Elvis and his Saltburn character, Felix, which sounds like it was quite a feat.
Yeah, I just recently caught up with Priscilla, and it's not like in that movie they're trying to really mask him as Elvis. It's not like the kind of transformation Austin Butler had, say, in Elvis. But it was funny the moments where I could see, like, Felix, the Saltburn character, kind of peeking out from under the Elvis hair and kind of realizing almost with the start that it was the same person, even though I knew that all along. It really did just point out to me how much he can play, you know, characters that aren't, like, hugely physically different, but that feel so different in his hands. I was really impressed thinking of them side by side.
Yeah, I did point out to him that, you know, both of these characters are dealing with sort of being the object of the object of obsession, you know, for the people around them, whether that's Elvis or in Felix, you know, he's this man that this other guy is really obsessed with. And I was like, you must deal with something similar with your rising fame. So it was also interesting to kind of dig into how he's been handling his time in the spotlight now.
You know, when David interviewed Charles Melton a few weeks ago, he was also asking him about, like, drawing on experiences of being famous to play these characters. And I feel like actors never want to, like, dive into it and admit that they're famous, but it is totally interesting to get into.
Yep. There's nothing I love more than talking to actors about being famous, and it seems like nothing they would want to talk about less.
What's amazing is both of them, we really know them because of the same show, Euphoria. How about that?
Wow. There we go.
Well, I mean, Coleman's been around for a long time, but that definitely elevated him.
Well, if you are an actor who wants to talk about being famous, please come on Little Gold Men. And in the meantime, let's hear Rebecca's conversation with the star of Priscilla and Saltburn, Jacob Elordi.
So Jacob Elordi is having quite a year. He stars as Elvis in Sofia Coppola's Priscilla and also stars in Emerald Fennell's Saltburn. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I've seen both your films. I think they really capture the range that you are able to deliver in performances. But I'm curious for you if you see anything in common about these two roles that ties them together.
That's a funny question. I made Priscilla 3 weeks after Saltburn. So they're strangely both kind of meshed together in my head because I would prep. I'd shoot all day in London and then I'd go home to my sort of this kind of Elvis cave, which was my hotel room, which was sort of all pictures of Priscilla, and I had the music playing and the films on. And so the two are kind of in my head linked together forever. But I think in the film, other than both of them having a kind of ginormous house between Saltburn and Graceland, I'm not sure if Felix has too much of Elvis Presley in him.
It's interesting because I was wondering if you had shot them close together, because is it difficult for you to sort of let one go and jump into the next? Do you need more than 3 weeks, you know, in a perfect world, or how do you go through that process?
I think the sort of short time is kind of what made it work for me in my head. I think if I'd had too long to worry about it, I would have been in a bit of strife because I would have overthought the whole thing. Because I had to do this British accent in Saltburn. So I got to lose that really quickly when I went into the Memphis draw. But it kind of, having the 3 weeks just gave me not a lot of time to worry about it, and I kind of had this deadline that I had to work to, which meant that I just kind of worked more efficiently, I guess. But at the time, before I'd started both of them, I thought it was going to be impossible because I'd gotten them around the same time.
Yeah, I know the Saltburn premiere was just the other night, so I thought we could start with that. I feel like that film is super fun to watch with an audience because it is visceral. There are, you know, moments that I think you get to feel the audience react. What is it like for you to watch that film with an audience?
Actually, I snuck into a screening of it in my hometown. And it was unbelievable. I haven't been in a movie like that, I think, probably since I want to say maybe I saw the first of the new Star Wars movies in theaters, and I thought it was a really special thing because it was Star Wars, and the audience was, you know, it was midday and everyone was there for it. But it was kind of surreal seeing it with Saltburn because there's no IP or anything. There's no original concept or anything. It's just like it's a new story, and to see people invested in the storylines and to hear people kind of going gasping and yelling, and hearing people in the drain scene go no God no, like it's a totally new cinematic experience, and I'm just like I can't believe I'm in it and I get to be a part of it.
Yeah. Well, tell me about Felix and why you felt like this would be an interesting character to take on.
I had met with Emerald a couple of years ago now in LA, and we had a general meeting and she was so vague about what the movie was. She was like, you know, we've got this film and there's these guys in it, and one is kind of like this and the other one's like this, but also it's not like that at all. Anyway, thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you. And I was just so intrigued. You know, I was like, what? That was like the most cryptic, specifically cryptic thing I've ever heard. And then I got the script and I just knew that I had to be in it. It was as fun on paper as it ended up being on screen. So then I happened to be in the UK a couple of months after that, and I got to audition for Emerald in the Room, which was my first audition outside of sort of COVID times. It was the first one back. Mm-hmm. So it was just terribly nerve-wracking. And it was everything. It brought me back to what performance was like. You know, and what it really is to be in the room and work for a role, and pretty much the experience from there was just like pure gold.
Yeah. I've talked to Emerald a couple times on this podcast, and she specifically said you brought something that a lot of the other actors who auditioned didn't, where, you know, Felix can seem, obviously he's this object of desire and he's charismatic and all of this, but that you sort of showed that he's also sort of weak and you know, is in these circumstances that he's in based on, you know, his family and who is he born to. I'm curious what you found in the layers of who Felix was. That
yeah. Emerald saw me in the room and she was like, he's weak. I'll take him.
But you saw more to him, I think, than maybe others.
I think it's just like, it's kind of uninteresting to sort of play tropes and ideas in films, and I think I've done them before. So I think now I just try to always. It was the same thing playing Elvis. I try to kind of find like a back door into the character. I try to sort of find them when they're 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. I try to find like the little boy in them, and I think that was the clearest thing to me with Felix was, you know, this guy's not just born he's born with an immense amount of privilege, but he's not born with this great, you know, swagger and, you know, strut. You have to kind of develop that and learn that. And a lot of the time, the people that you meet that have that kind of sensibility, it usually comes from a place of great insecurity or misunderstanding of their place in the world. So I think for me, it was just trying to, I hate to use the kind of corny phrase, but trying to humanize him and really make him a person instead of just this kind of movie character, you know.
And what does preparation look like for you? You know, as you're saying, Saltburn is original. It's not based on real people. Like, where do you get inspiration from when you're, you know, preparing in the weeks before you start production?
Well, I'd called Emerald because she knows the world a lot more than I do. Mm-hmm. And she sent me a list of films and books to read, and I kind of took myself out to Palm Springs for 2 weeks and just locked myself away and wore only linen and walked around a swimming pool trying to find this, you know, this accent. And I read Brideshead Revisited and just kind of studied that sort of English literature and that world of immense privilege as best I could. Yeah. And then I got to London 4 weeks before filming. I lived in Chelsea, and it was unbelievable. I would just go down to the coffee shops and listen to people talk and order their flat whites, and people's voices really were like this, and they said "lush" and things like that. And that was kind of the final puzzle piece to realize you couldn't really go too far with it, you know?
Yeah. And the dynamic between you and Barry's character is so important for this story. What did the two of you need? Did you do a lot of rehearsal? Like, how did you sort of find that dynamic?
I think it was just immediately, as soon as we met each other, we were just best mates. There was something common in us, I think. But he just called me and he's like, let's go, let's do this. He's super enthusiastic. And he doesn't really play by any rules. He just gets straight to the point, you know. I was just terribly excited to be working with him because I think he's every actor's actor. You want to work with Barry Keoghan, you know, you want to know what it's all about. And he was just, for me, he was pure electricity the whole time. Like we just naturally found each other. And I think loved each other and that was kind of it. There wasn't really a great deal of work to do between the two of us, which is just really lucky.
Yeah. Was there any scene in particular that you maybe felt more intimidated by, or you felt like you had to put a little more work in to prepare for? Because, you know, I think this story, it pushes actors. There's a lot of challenging performance moments in it.
You know what? I think it was as soon as we got to the summer house, because my family came into it, and I think it was more a personal fear of, okay, I have to be English around Rosamund Pike Carey Mulligan.
Legit English people.
Yeah. If anyone's going to see through you, it's going to be Rosamund Pike. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there was something very daunting about coming out to the house, because that's also sort of where everything unravels and you start to see the pieces of Felix that aren't college bravado, you know, and things like that. So I think everything at the house. But then once we got there, it became our home. We were there for so long. Everything kind of became second nature.
Yeah. From what I understand, you know, everything was at that one location to really make you feel comfortable, like this was your home.
Yeah. I mean, Rosamund slept at the house. Our whole crew was sort of staying out there. Everybody was at the pubs in the area. It was really like we were the family of the manor for a little while.
Like summer camp. Very messed really, up summer
it was,
camp.
It was like, it was this incredibly wealthy summer camp.
And so, you know, when it came to Priscilla, and it sounds like you had to do a lot of your studying while shooting Saltburn, but I know you studied documentaries and footage for your portrayal of Elvis, but was there one item of research that ended up being sort of breaking it open for you, or that ended up being really valuable in your preparation?
Yeah, certainly. There was two. Peter Gerlinick's book was incredibly helpful. It's full of information, but you get this feeling as you read both books that pretty much you get this kind of great sadness sort of washed over me when I was reading them, because you just feel this meteoric plummet to hell, basically. Like his life was, you know, just it really was a tragedy in so many ways. And then the things that kind of helped me with finding sort of the human being that I wanted to portray was there were these home videos called Elvis by the Presleys, and there was all this sort of silent Super 8 footage of him over the years, and you got to see him playing with Priscilla and swimming and eating food like a child, and you can really see the little boy in him. And it was that, and then the song, there was one song that kind of tied me to it the whole time, and it was his version of Bridge Over Troubled Water. And every day I would listen to that before going on set, and it kind of centered the whole thing and, you know, confirmed the weight of it, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. Were there songs that you listened to before doing Saltburn?
Before doing Saltburn, yeah. Emerald had made us a wicked playlist of 2007 bangers, you know, Block Party, all that kind of stuff. But before getting there, I listened to I had this idea that it would be kind of annoyingly alt. So I had, you know, the Smiths and I had a lot of David Bowie playing, a lot of that kind of British 80s, you know, rock pop sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you're kind of touching on this, you know, as your career sort of grows and grows, there are points where you have to make decisions about which direction you want to go. I think both of these projects speak to the type of roles that you seem to be gravitating towards. But how would you describe what you say yes to and what you say no to at this point of where you are?
I think it's always changing. The one thing that I'm lucky enough now to have is the ability to kind of choose a little bit. And I think about it a little bit, but I just want to work with artists, and it's totally personal. It's just what I like. Like I've loved art my whole life, really. And I just want to work with filmmakers who have a specific point of view or a feeling about something, and they want to leave that mark sort of on the world and in history. That's what movies sort of are to me, and that's sort of what I want to, what I hope I can continually be a part of is a part of sort of other artists' visions, to be kind of in service to other artists. That's always the sort of most fulfilling thing to me, as opposed to kind of just, there's a lot of making movies for money, which is so, so fine. And it is, you know, it is the business. But I really, really, really love to work with artists that I admire.
And how would you say these two projects helped you grow as an actor? I mean, were there things you took away that maybe will go with you to the next project and the next project?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, Saltburn for me, it was the ensemble, the people that I got to work with. I've sort of working with these people who've been working their whole lives, working with Emerald, working with the crew in England. I'll have that forever. It was just a really, really personal experience. And then playing Elvis, I mean, working with Sophia is, you know, I think anyone in the world, even if you didn't make movies, you want to do something with Sophia Coppola. So there's that. But I think it felt like this, you know, I think I said this before, it felt like I had to climb Everest or something like that. You know, I had to climb this giant mountain, and there's this moment when you get over it and you do it, and then people liked it. I think I gained maybe confidence is the wrong word, but I'll use it. I feel a lot more confident. I feel like what I think I'm capable of has sort of been confirmed to myself a little bit, and hopefully I don't lose that. Hopefully that stays with me.
Yeah, and we're almost out of time, but the strike is over. People can get back to work. What's next for you? Are you heading back to set? Where do you go from here?
Yeah, I'm shooting right now. I'm doing this limited series called The Narrow Road to the Deep North with Justin Kurzel, a brilliant Australian filmmaker. So we're just about to get back into that on Monday. I play Dorigo Evans, who's a World War II prisoner of war and a medical surgeon.
And is being on set your favorite part of the process, or do you love prep?
That's the process. I mean, action and cut is, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be anything without the prep, I don't think, for me, but action and cut is, you know, you're really alive in that.
That does it for today's Little Gold Men. We'll be back on Thursday. Find us in the meantime at vanityfair.com, on social media at VF Awards Insider. You can follow me at Katie Rich and David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.